I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the American West as a land of big dreams and enormous heartbreaks. We'll spend this hour with historian H.W. Brands, whose new book looks at the ways our ideas about the West have been shaped by wishful thinking for centuries, as fortune seekers imagined untold wealth there for the taking, and longtime inhabitants and newcomers struggled violently for control. We'll talk about the persistent myth of rugged independence as Western ethos, despite the reality that almost nobody survived in harsh landscapes without cooperation. And we'll talk about the federal government's active efforts to facilitate westward expansion by white settlers. Our conversation starts after a short break. Things Americans have been told about the West. It was largely open when white settlers streamed in throughout the 19th century with dreams as big as the landscape. And those dreams were best suited to tough and rugged individualists, people who chafed at government interference and were solely responsible for their own success. Today, we're going to talk about the extent to which all of that is wrong and about why the myth of the West became so firmly embedded in the American psyche. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest today is historian H.W. Brands. He is Jack S. Blanton Senior Chair in History at the University of Texas at Austin, and his latest book untangles the web of half-truths we've told ourselves about expansion toward the Pacific Coast to reveal stories that are every bit as compelling as the fantasies we've relied on to explain who we are as a people. The new book is called Dreams of El Dorado, A History of the American West. H.W. Brands joins us from the studios of KUT in Austin to talk about it. Bill, welcome back to Think.
Delighted to be with you again.
You say the creation of the American West is one of the greatest accomplishments in the history of the federal government. What made the founding of the West inherently different from the development of the Atlantic coast and what was east of the Mississippi?
Well, the first and easiest explanation is at the time of the founding of the English colonies on the Atlantic coast, there was no government of the United States. And so one of the first acts of the federal government of the United States under the Constitution was the purchase of new territory, the Louisiana Purchase, which is where I begin my story. And the subtitle of the book is the History of the American West. And the Trans-Mississippi West, the region of the country that I focus on, really isn't an American, as in a U.S. West, until that point. The United States had no claim, no legal title to land west of the Mississippi before the Louisiana Purchase. So the story kicks off at that point. And to get back to your question, it was the American West, the Trans-Mississippi West, was a creation of the federal government. It wouldn't have been part of the United States until purchase or otherwise acquisition by the U.S. government.
I might be docked 10 points if I were an undergrad in one of your classes for not knowing this, but I didn't know until I read this book, Bill, that Jefferson initiated the Louisiana Purchase with like a much smaller acquisition in mind.
Jefferson was conflicted about this question of westward expansion. He was most interested in the West as a scientific place to study, to find out what the wildlife was and the geography was like. But he had serious reservations, at least until he became president, about the nature of presidential power. He was a strict constructionist of the Constitution, which meant that, in his view, again, until he became president, he believed that if the Constitution did not explicitly give the president, or for that matter, Congress, authority to purchase, to acquire new territory, then the president or the Congress could not. But Napoleon offered him a deal that was simply too good to pass up. What Jefferson had sent his diplomats to Paris to do was to purchase rights to New Orleans, to make sure that American farmers in the Ohio and Mississippi valleys could store their produce on docks in New Orleans, perhaps even purchase the city. But that was a small thing. Napoleon originally had reacquired Louisiana from Spain, thinking that he was going to somehow reconstitute France's New World Empire. Didn't work out. He ran into yellow fever and an uprising in Haiti. And so he gave up the idea. And he said to Jefferson's diplomats, okay, you want New Orleans, how about all of Louisiana for only 50% more than the Americans are going to offer for the city of New Orleans? And so it was a fantastic deal. But Jefferson agonized over this because it really went against his philosophy of governance. Meanwhile, his Federalist opponents, the ones who had long said that the government has more expansive powers than the Constitution narrowly says, they delighted in the agonizing that Jefferson was doing. And they could have caused him more trouble. They too realized this was a deal of a lifetime. Jefferson thought about maybe amending the Constitution. That would resolve the problem, but amending the Constitution takes a long time, and Napoleon might change his mind. So he swallowed his scruples and cut the deal. And the United States, for the first time, had territory west of the Mississippi River.
You said that Jefferson's attitudes toward trade in the West were like the complete opposite of his normal positions on trade.
The West basically caused people to take different positions than they did in other parts. So Jefferson was notorious for being skeptical of, disrespectful of merchants and trade. It was Jefferson who persuaded Congress in 1807 to pass an embargo act that basically banned all American exports. It's really hard to think of a president basically shooting the American economy in the foot like that. But this is because Jefferson was not a business person. But when he sent Lewis and Clark, the explorers, to investigate this new purchase, Louisiana Purchase, one of the things he was very interested in was pushing American trade, first with the Native American peoples, but also he had this idea that somehow there might be a way to use Louisiana, this large territory, as a stepping stone to East Asia, to the China market. It had been the dream, of course, of explorers for a long time to find a water route to the Indies. This is what Columbus was looking for in the first place, but he ran into the Americas. But even as late as the beginning of the 19th century, there was a thought that somehow there might be a water route across North America. No one, at least no whites, had ever been to the headwaters of the Mississippi. And Jefferson had in mind, well, he knew a little bit about the geography of Russia, where the headwaters of rivers that drain into the Baltic Sea, they almost intermingle with the headwaters of rivers that go into the Black Sea. So you can cross Russia essentially by water with a small and easy portage. You could even put a canal in there. And Jefferson was thinking, so maybe that's the same thing. Because the Columbia River, there was known that there was this great river of the West, but nobody knew where its headwaters were. And of course, the Mississippi and Missouri, there was the great river system of the East. And maybe the headwaters of the two were very close together. And part of the idea that Lewis and Clark were supposed to investigate is, could there be a water route from the East Coast of the United States to the West Coast of, well, it's not yet the United States because the United States didn't have Pacific frontage of this. But that was one of the reasons he was so interested in Louisiana and so interested in the Corps of Discovery, as the Lewis and Clark expedition was formally titled.
So Lewis and Clark, I mean, it was a big deal that they even survived and made it there and back. They came back with amazing science and information. But they also, in some ways, sort of what they all dreamed of failed because they proved just how arduous overland travel would be from the eastern United States to the far west reaches.
Yeah. So when Lewis and Clark headed off into the wilderness, they pretty much lost contact with the east. It was a bit as though today the United States sent an expedition to Mars. So there's going to be a Mars landing. And 2 weeks after it takes off from the United States, they lose radio contact. And no one knows what happened to them. And then after a blank period of however long it takes to get to Mars and maybe add on a while, all of a sudden they pop up again. In fact, people didn't know that Lewis and Clark had survived and made it to the Pacific coast until they'd been gone a year and a half. And a lot of people thought, well, they must have been killed by the Indians or they've fallen off a waterfall or something like that. And then they show up at St. Louis on the return. And this is a marvelous thing. And they brought back these journals and they brought back these stories about what the West includes. But especially for Jefferson, there was this moment of disappointment that one of the things he'd been hoping for, this easy route to the Pacific, well, it turns out it's not easy at all. And there's a moment I describe in the book, it's a moment that Lewis and Clark record in their journals of when they encounter the falls of the Missouri River. And until then, the Missouri was this flowing stream, but you could take boats up there. And then there's these series of waterfalls that they realize just one after the other, no way we're ever going to take boats over this. So they, in fact, have to go overland themselves. And it's at that point that this dream of the water connection just evaporates.
So this show is produced out of Texas. We talk a lot about undocumented immigration in Texas these days. You remind us quite pointedly that the original illegal immigrants to Texas were Europeans.
Yes. And so when Stephen Austin founded his colony of the old 300s, they call them in Texas, these were authorized immigrants. In fact, they were invited into Mexican Texas by the Mexican government. Not only were they invited, they were granted big pieces of land, a league of land, 4,000 acres, which made them princes, landed princes by comparison with what they would get in the United States. And they were both very well-mannered, and they were law-abiding, and they had an incentive for Texas to remain part of Mexico because they had their land under Mexican law. But when other people heard about the opportunities of the land in Texas, they came in regardless of what the law said. They weren't invited until there's a moment about 10 years after the first colony was settled where the Mexican government realized that things are just out of control. So they send this border commission up to the border, which is the Sabine River between Texas and Louisiana. And the report that comes back is an army general who conducts the investigation. And he says, unless we do something about this illegal immigration, Texas is lost. And in fact, Texas was lost within the next decade.
Did Sam Houston accurately characterize the hunger that settlers in Texas had for independence from Mexico?
So the two founding fathers of American Texas are Stephen Austin and Sam Houston. Stephen Austin was the one who brought the Americans in under Mexican law. And in fact, Stephen Austin's whole model of the future of Texas and of his own future was that Texas would remain part of Mexico. Sam Houston came in as Andrew Jackson's secret agent. He said he was going to investigate affairs with the Indians who lived around and then in Texas. But Sam Houston had an entirely different idea. Houston, for his own personal reasons, he had had a disastrous marriage that led him on a 2-year-long bender, and he had lost the respect of Andrew Jackson, who was essentially his surrogate father. And Jackson was scratching his head wondering whatever became of Sam Houston. So Houston decides that he is going to go and seize Texas for the United States. He knew that Jackson had his eye on Texas, but Jackson, as president of the United States, was simply negotiating for the purchase of Texas, and the Mexican government wasn't inclined to sell. So Houston goes, and he says that he polls all these Americans in Texas to determine whether they would like to be independent of Mexico or not. He didn't keep any records. You know, there's no way of checking up on him. He said that the overwhelming majority was in favor of separating Texas from Mexico and attaching it to the United States. There certainly was a sentiment along those lines that existed, but it did not include people like Stephen Austin and the people in Texas who had acquired their property legally. Because if Texas were separated from Mexico, they could expect that their land titles would be challenged. They would be under a new system of law. So in fact, there is this conflict, direct conflict, between these two heroes of early American Texas. And it's only when Santa Anna, the president and general in chief of Mexico, basically dissolves the Mexican Congress and overturns the Mexican Constitution, that Austin comes around and says, okay, the future of Texas is no longer safe under this new regime in Mexico City. And so at that point, Austin and Houston align. And the result of it is the Texas Revolution, basically a war of secession by Americans in Texas. And it actually included some of the Tejanos, the Mexicans in Texas, against who are upset with the goings-on in Mexico City, who fight this war of independence and make Texas independent of Mexico. Now, the original plan, certainly of Houston, maybe not so much Austin, was that then Texas would immediately be annexed to the United States. But the United States wouldn't have Texas at that point because Texas insisted on keeping its slaves. And there was a sufficiently large minority in the U.S. Senate that could block a treaty of annexation. And so Texas remained on the outside for 9 years. These are the years of the Texas Republic, years that Texans remember now very fondly, but that wasn't their idea at all. In fact, the years of the Texas Republic were a difficult and dangerous time to be in Texas.
And ultimately, the Texas Republic gave up its independence in order to keep its slaves. Is that right?
In which part are you referring to?
Well, eventually, wasn't there supposed to be a deal, you know, the English would have sort of helped them maintain their independence?
Well, so the slaveholders in Texas never had any idea that they were going to give up their slaves. But the British government at this time had become an abolitionist government, having given up its slaves a decade earlier. And so the British were angling aid to Texas as an independent republic if Texas would give up its slaves. But that was essentially a non-starter because the people who held the political power in Texas were not going to give up their slaves that easily.
My guest is H.W. Brands, Jack S. Blanton, Senior Chair in History at the University of Texas at Austin and author of Dreams of El Dorado, A History of the American West. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is historian H.W. Brands of the University of Texas at Austin, whose new book is called Dreams of El Dorado, A History of the American West. Bill, why was the West such a draw for Christian evangelists?
Basically, you could go on a mission and not have to leave North America. That's sort of what it came down to. There is, among certain Protestant sects, as in among other religious groups, in some cases, a desire to win new converts to the faith. And so Protestant missionaries realized that there were Native American tribes in the West who had never heard the gospel, and this would be an open field for conversion. Now, in the case of certain Native American tribes of the West, there was an additional draw, sort of a positive draw and maybe a potentially negative draw. Roman Catholic missionaries had gotten out to the Pacific Northwest early. They had arrived with fur traders from British Canada, and they were French Canadian mostly, but they were Catholics, and they'd gotten out there. And when the Protestants discovered, when American interest was first drawn to the Pacific Northwest after the voyages of Robert Gray in the late 18th century, then they realized that, oh my gosh, if we don't get out there, then the Catholics will get all the conversions. But there was also a moment when there were some members of a Native American tribe, the Flatheads of the Idaho area, who came to one of the rendezvous. The rendezvous was basically a trade association meeting of the fur trade that was held in the middle of the Rocky Mountains every summer. It's when the fur merchants would go up from St. Louis to meet the fur trappers who would come with the pelts that they had gathered over the previous year. And the traders would sell the trappers what they needed, their bullets and the lead and salt and all the other stuff they need, and they would get the pelts. But it was also a social gathering. And some Indians come from the West, and they ask for, and so they get there, and then eventually they get all the way to St. Louis, and they ask for some black robes. They want to learn about this book that they had heard about, this good book. And the Protestant missionaries who heard this, the story was actually first reported in one of the Protestant newspapers at the time. They, of course, interpreted this as somehow these four, there were four of them, these wise men of the West, as they were identified, they had perhaps been touched by grace or by God to come seek the gospel. And once the story circulated among the mission boards of the Protestant groups in the American East, they could not resist. And so they could easily raise money and send people off to the West. And some of the folks who went to the West, well, most of the missionaries who went to the West had very little idea of what they were getting into, but it was hardly different than when they would go on missions to other continents as well. If you're, you know, confident of your view of the gospel and you think that you're doing God's work, then there's a strong temptation to say, you know, God will provide. So just head out and God will provide. But it's interesting because in most of the history of the United States, as in the part that's going to become the United States itself, there's very little of the missionizing impulse. But there definitely was in the case of the West. And in fact, one of the main characters of my story is a woman named Narcissa Whitman. She and her husband, it was kind of an arranged marriage because they both wanted to become missionaries to the West, but they were single. They hadn't met each other. And they were informed, he was informed, that their strong preference was given to married men because there was a concern that they might form a liaison with one of the Native women, one of the Aboriginal women of the West. And that wasn't good. That didn't seem to be a good example. Or maybe they wouldn't even, you know, get married or anything like that. And they definitely wouldn't allow single women, single white women, to go out to the West. So these two, Marcus and Narcissa Whitman, each sort of learn of each other's existence. They decide, okay, let's get married. and then we can go out to the West on the mission. And for the historian, for me in this case, the great thing is that Narcissa keeps this journal, the journal of not only the journey across the American West, which is a great account. She and another woman who were along with her were the first two American women to make the journey, apparently the first two white women to cross the continent. And then it tells the story of her trials, challenges, tribulations at the mission that she and her husband create in what now is southeastern Washington. And without giving away the story, things do not end well for Marcus and Narcissa Whitman.
Well, we won't get to that part of the story, but I have to say I was struck by this book is full of irony. It's really a theme throughout many of these stories. The irony of her name being Narcissa, she wasn't that interested in learning local languages. She wasn't particularly able to understand the sort of full humanity of the people she was trying to convert.
There's a strange kind of, well, you could call it self-confidence. In this case, I suppose I could call it narcissism. That sometimes comes with that missionary mindset. Because if you're convinced that you're on God's mission and this is what God wants, then you're not always that inclined to make accommodation for the people that you're dealing with. Yeah. And in Narcissa Whitman's case, she just had the wrong personality for doing what she was doing. She didn't have any tolerance for new ways. She didn't have any curiosity. She didn't really try to learn about the people that she was dealing with. And when they did things that she didn't expect or didn't like, she blamed them rather than try to understand why they were doing what they were doing. It didn't help matters at all that this point of contact with the native peoples of the area, in particular, they were among the Cayuse Indians, coincided with the beginning of large migration to Oregon from the eastern part of the United States, and the migrants brought in various diseases. And so there was a measles epidemic that was taking place while she was trying to make these connections, such as her efforts were, and it decimated the Cayuse tribe. And they would ask themselves, so what's going on here? Because this was before anybody knew how infectious diseases worked. And it was often attributed to bad spirits or something. And so here is this group, this small group of missionaries who are bringing in these strange gods and challenging our traditional views of things. And then all of our people die. Well, it's sort of tempting to blame the missionaries for this.
You mentioned fur trappers and traders a few minutes ago. And I have to say, I sort of pictured these folks as like one-off kind of on their own people with a bunch of pelts on their back, maybe marching into like a town somewhere to trade at a trading post. But this was a vast industry. Will you describe for us just how big this got at its height?
So this is one of the striking parts of the story. So the trappers, the individual trappers do their stuff in the remotest parts of North America. And it's a really difficult place to live. And lots of times they're on their own where they're actually doing the trapping. But they, in fact, were part of one of the first and most extensively globalized industries in American history. Because what they were doing was chasing down beaver for the soft under fur of the beaver, which would be processed into a kind of wool felt that would be used to make hats that fashionable gentlemen in London would wear. Hmm. And so there was this entire industry built about a particular taste in fashion. Now, the main character who carries my story through this point is a guy named Joe Meek, who was born in Virginia. He's a young man, didn't want to become a farmer, so he goes off for adventure, and he finds his adventure in the mountains. And he spends about 8 or 10 years in the mountains when he discovers that the business wasn't what it used to be. He's not fully aware of the corporate competition and how the different companies were competing with each other, but he is aware that there's just not the demand anymore for this thing that he had devoted, by this time, probably a third of his life to pursuing. And he basically is out of a job. He has to find a new job. He becomes a farmer. And he doesn't fully realize it, but he's a victim of this global industry, which in turn has turned on its head because those fashionable gents in London got tired of the beaver hats, and what they're now wearing are silk hats. And so Joe Meek is sort of a victim to an evolving economy, a global economy, in very much the same way that American factory workers in the late 20th century lost their jobs due to the changing nature of the global industries of their day.
There was also this problem of a kind of collapse of supply. Why did nobody realize initially that it was possible to, like, tap out sources of wealth from animals, from timber, from other natural resources?
Well, this is a good example of what various economists call the tragedy of the commons. Mm-hmm. So nobody owned the beaver until somebody trapped it. And as long as it's out there free, you have every incentive to grab that one. There was no body that could enforce restraint on other people, so that, you know, if you denied yourself trapping this particular beaver, somebody else would grab it. And there was no group, there was no OPEC, so to speak, of the fur business, in part because it didn't last that long. Everybody knew the resource was going to run out. They had already trapped out the otters on the Pacific Northwest coast. And I suspect at some level, people who were involved in this understood that this is a fashion fad that's not going to last forever. So we might as well get while we can.
How did Joe Meek finally set down roots in Oregon?
Well, so he came down out of the mountains. He and a couple of other friends, trappers, realized, okay, this industry isn't what it used to be. So let's go on to Oregon. They had seen all the people going through the Rocky Mountains toward Oregon. And so they thought, well, let's go there. Meek had lost touch with his family back in Virginia, and he was one who always had itchy feet anyway. So they go off to Oregon, and they become farmers. They learn. So the thing that Meek didn't want to be in Virginia was what he wound up being in Oregon. It also turned out that he had a knack for personal relations. He was an engaging guy, and he could talk people into, well, he entered politics when he was in Oregon. And he was elected sheriff, and he did one thing and another. He was also getting older. And anybody who had been in the mountains for as long as he had, and 10 years in the mountains was a long time, he probably realized that he was pushing his luck, because most people who started off in the mountains didn't survive very long. This was the reason that the trading companies, the fur companies, had to recruit every summer. They'd go to St. Louis and then find new people, because the attrition rate, the mortality rate in the industry was pretty high. So I think he realized that he wasn't going to grow old if he stayed in the mountains. He might grow old if he moved down into the lowlands, into the Willamette Valley.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We all know, Bill, that fortunes were made in the gold rush. It's fascinating to consider that it was often more lucrative to sell supplies to prospectors than to discover gold for oneself.
Yeah, so this is an interesting part of the story. Gold's discovered in California. People head out to California to grab the gold. And again, sort of like the beaver, it didn't belong to anybody until somebody grabbed it. This is a big part of the story. If there's a single underlying story about the American West during this time, it's the race for the natural resources of the West. It's the struggle for the natural resources of the West, because the running wars with the Indians were all about who's going to control these resources. In the case of California, they go out to get the gold, and the easiest pickings are picked over very quickly. And so you can, if you're in the first wave, you can just reach down in the streams with a pan, and you can make yourself some gold. And you can find yourself some gold, and you can make yourself some money. And the dream, what this one was, that somebody who heard about the stories coming from California would reckon that, okay, I'm a farmer in New York State, or I'm a blacksmith in Kentucky, something like that, and it's going to take me 10 years, 20 years to sort of make a modest fortune. I can go out to California, and in a season or two in the gold fields, I can make as much as I would make in 20 years back home. And so off they go. Well, it doesn't take long for the easy pickings to be picked over. And then things get harder. Technology has to be brought in. Capital has to be invested in order to make these things work. There were some people who got out there, and they realized, okay, you know, all these people coming out, they're going to need supplies. And if I'm not the kind of person who wants to stand waist deep in freezing water, panning gold, moving rocks, and all that other stuff, I don't want to do that kind of heavy lifting. I'm a merchant. So Leland Stanford had been a grocer back in the East, and so he goes out there, and he basically became a grocer again. He sold supplies to the miners. So there are basically two models of business success in the gold fields. One was mining the gold, and the other was mining the miners. And the ones who mined the miners actually made the more stable, the more long-lasting fortunes.
So did California industrialize ahead of a lot of places to the east?
Yeah, so that's another great sort of paradox or irony about the settlement of the West. So the West is this wild place, and there's nobody there, and it's tempting to think, okay, it's rural and it's unindustrialized. But in fact, everybody who went to California, nearly everybody went for the gold, and they all congregated around where the gold was. So California was one of the most, if not the most, urbanized state in the Union from its very creation, because everybody was congregated where the gold was. Secondly, although it was a frontier society in some ways, this frontier was an industrial frontier because it didn't take long for the gold to retreat from or to be taken from the stream beds where an individual could get it on his own. They were almost all men. Then you had to bring in machines. Until before long, you had to dig these holes, these mine shafts, into the ground. So the people who didn't get it on the first wave, but the second or third wave, they found that they were essentially industrial workers. They were like coal miners in Pennsylvania, except that they were mining for gold instead of for coal. And this, for many of them, this was not what they had encountered at all. So part of the story, the title of the book is Dreams of El Dorado. And more often than not, the dreams were not borne out by the reality.
How did the secession of the South from the Union facilitate the creation of a transcontinental railroad?
As early as the administration of Thomas Jefferson, when Jefferson realized that there was no easy water route to the Pacific coast, even he began to think that if the West Coast was somehow came under the title of the United States, it would be hard to keep it as part of the United States because it was so hard to get there. It took so long to get there. And that there might be develop a Pacific sister republic of the United States, the Atlantic Republic. Now, this difficulty of getting there persisted until the 1860s, till the beginning of the Civil War. Because to get to California, you still had to sail around South America, or at least go down to Central America and then take a horseback ride or mule ride or something across the isthmus and then take another boat up the Pacific coast, or go overland, which could take 4 months. When the Civil War, when secession came and California had all this gold, Californians were tempted to secede from the Union, not necessarily to join the Confederacy, but they thought they could become independent. At that point, when that idea came up, then the government of the Union, the government of the United States, said, we got to keep California in the Union. Let's build a transcontinental railroad. Then what took 4 months to get to overland on foot can be retraced in 4 days on a train, and immediately the secessionist sympathies in California dissipated.
My guest is H.W. Brands, Jack S. Blanton Jr. Chair in History at the University of Texas at Austin and author of Dreams of El Dorado, A History of the American West. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with historian H.W. Brands. He is Jack S. Blanton Jr. Chair in History at UT Austin and author of a brand new book called Dreams of El Dorado, A History of the American West. Bill, pretty much every victory for white people in the West catalyzed like an equal and opposite defeat or loss for Native peoples for a variety of reasons. But you explained that Sioux tribes were kind of an anomaly at a time when a lot of other Native populations were vanishing. How were the Sioux able to build population through the first half of the 19th century?
Well, the short answer is that they figured out how to get inoculated against smallpox. Hmm. And this was a case where they had an alliance with fur traders coming out of St. Louis, and the Sioux were building an empire in the upper Great Plains. They were doing it in large part utilizing technologies that had arrived with the Europeans. And the two technologies were, first of all, the horse, and secondly, firearms. And so they were building their own empire, and it served the purposes of many of the fur traders to help them with this, because they would become the ones who would actually gather the furs. And so they were getting inoculated for smallpox. And so they developed a resistance that other tribes didn't have. So at a time when nearly every other tribe's population was declining, if not collapsing, the Sioux population was growing. And so they found themselves, this is one of the reasons that they were able to resist the white encroachment longer than the other tribes. This, I mean, something similar was going on in the Southern Plains where the Comanches were building an empire in Texas. And a striking part of the story is that in these cases, in any event, it wasn't as though the whites were encountering tribes that had been there from time immemorial. The Sioux had only come out on the plains in the last century or two, and then when they got the horse, they became this very formidable cavalry. In the case of the Comanches in Texas, the reason that the Mexican government invited Stephen Austin and his colonists to come to Texas was precisely so they could form a buffer against the invading Comanches. So it's a story of conflict, and it's the conflict had been going on from before the time the whites got there, and it continued through the whole period until, well, I basically end my story at the end of the 19th century when the West, which had been this zone of persistent violence, has been settled and pacified, brutally pacified in many respects, and the end of the resistance is the massacre at Wounded Knee in 1890. But at that point, the struggle for mastery, for control of the resources of the West, essentially ends. This is now part of the United States. And as an aspect of that, through most of the 19th century, the West was a region under American title, but outside American law. There was no law in the West. There weren't even territorial governments. And this is what made the Wild West wild. By the end of the 19th century, every square foot of the West is, most of it's under state governments, so the states that have admitted to the Union, and the small part of the rest in New Mexico and Arizona is under territorial governments. So that Wild West has passed now.
Before Wounded Knee, what had Black Elk's vision been for his people?
Black Elk was a medicine man, a visionary among the Sioux, the Lakota. And he had this vision of sort of this, a circle of peace, a circle of life. It's a little bit unclear what exactly it consisted of because some of it was quite explicitly mystical. So he dreamed that he was taken up into the heavens by, and he would ride on these magical horses. So it was a little bit unclear, but at the center of it was the Lakota people, and this was going to be their land, and this was going to be their future. And the story of Black Elk, who is a memoirist of this period in Lakota history, is, well, his life coincides, the first half of his life coincides with the arrival of the whites. And so he is this eyewitness to basically the demise of the traditional Lakota way of existence. And he lives long enough that he's able to tell the story. And his telling of the story captures the emotions that this young boy, when the story begins, that he relates, and then young man, the emotions that it captures. Some people have objected that, okay, this is a story told long after the fact. I mean, that makes it very much like other memoirs. But certainly it recaptures what it was like to be a member of the Lakota tribe in the sort of the last glory days of the tribe before they were all forced onto reservations.
Was there something inevitable about the fact that so much of the history of the American West, at least subsequent to the time of European Americans' explorations, was written in blood? Could different kinds of people have settled the West peacefully?
The answer to that question, I suppose, depends on one's view of human nature. And for that kind of outcome to have actually taken place would have required, well, say the Americans, because this is the group that's encroaching on the native people's land, it would have required a kind of self-denial that I personally can't think of. I don't know of any other instance in history where it occurred. It would have required the whites to say to a very much smaller number of Native Americans, okay, you can keep that vast territory and and we'll stay off, even as our numbers are increasing dramatically. So, I mean, what it comes down to is the population pressure was such that, it makes a difference that the United States was a democracy. So Ulysses Grant developed an Indian policy that had the best possible intentions toward the Native Americans during his presidency. And he wanted to keep whites out of the Black Hills of Dakota, because the Black Hills were sacred to the Lakota, to the Sioux. And he even went to the point where he staked federal troops around the Black Hills to keep people out. But gold was discovered in the Black Hills. And once gold was discovered in the Black Hills, then great demand arose among the American people, which translated into political demand against the president to say, we've got to open up the Black Hills. So when you have a political system in which the people ultimately decide, and there are lots of people who say, there's some resources out in the West that I could make a lot better use of than the people who live there. And the fact that by this time the whites enormously outnumbered the Native Americans, it would take a real leap of imagination to come up with a scenario that's at all historically plausible where things would have turned out differently.
It seems like there's a particular antipathy in sort of Western American culture to government intervention as a hindrance to freedom. I mean, you've made it really clear that lots of actions by the federal government in particular were necessary to create the West as we ultimately would know it. Why did that antagonism toward governance develop as part of the culture of the West?
I suppose it depends sort of partly on the individuals. But it seems to me that there's a bit of protesting too much in that people, for example, who run cattle on public land, it's not their land, they want to be these rugged individuals. At some level, they know they're not. This is not my own land. This is land that belongs to the people of the United States. And it's almost as though they have to sort of state it more strongly than they otherwise would. Now, some of it also is the fact that one of the appeals of the West is that it's lightly populated. And you can, and not now, but in the 19th century. And you can go out there and you're not constantly faced with the tax collector. You're not constantly faced with the cop on the beat. You can, if you choose a place that's remote enough, you can do things your own way. Now, you didn't buy that land. In fact, you're a squatter on the land. But once you get used to doing things your own way, you kind of like to do them your own way and you resist being told what to do. This was a story of the American colonies and why they finally broke away from the British Empire, because the British decided to crack down on the Americans doing things their own way. And I mean, it can be as personal as people who live by themselves for a long time often don't make good partners, you know, when they get married because they're so used to having things their own way. So there's a bit of that too.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. This book starts and ends with stories about Theodore Roosevelt, who in many ways created his own myth as kind of a character in the West. What made him think he could change his life by going to Dakota Territory, and how did that turn out for him?
Well, the reason he goes out to Dakota in the first place is that he's a hunter. And because he had a sickly childhood and all this stuff, he equates hunting animals, killing animals, with showing his strength, that he's not the weakling he was when he was a kid. That's what first takes him out there. He gets there, and like many other visitors to the West, he's just enthralled by what he sees. He's in the Badlands of Dakota, and it strikes him as just this sort of magical kind of place. And so he really likes it. He has just inherited a bunch of money from his deceased father, and he's trying to figure out, what am I going to do with it? So he decides to buy a cattle ranch. Well, shortly thereafter, his wife, with whom he was head over heels in love, dies in childbirth, complications of childbirth. So he's utterly distraught. And in order to somehow reclaim a calm in his soul, he goes out to the West, which he finds very calm. He wasn't the first person for whom that was the case. And when he's out there, he discovers that he really likes the people of the West. He likes the cowboys of the West. And like very many other people, he is entranced by this, the cowboy, by the myth of the cowboy. And he imagines that, boy, I could be a cowboy too. Now, he was kind of an odd cowboy because he wore these thick glasses and his riding clothes were made by Brooks Brothers. But nonetheless, he persists and he wins the respect of the cowboys on the Dakota frontier. And boy, this is one of the high points of his life. Now, a very harsh winter in 1886-87 basically freezes him out, kills most of his cattle. He loses most of his fortune there. And he eventually, well, then he falls in love back in the East with an old flame, and he really moves back there. But he never loses his emotional connection to the West. And it turned out to be political dynamite for him because he is this silk stocking New York rich kid, and that would have really placed a limit on his advancement in politics. But there is this Western side of him. And when the war with Spain breaks out in 1898 and he organizes this volunteer cavalry group, which the newspapermen at the time call the Rough Riders, boy, on the Rough Riders, these are cowboys and Indians going to war for the United States against dastardly Spain. And so he becomes a hero in the process. But it's this Western connection. And Roosevelt himself said on numerous occasions that if not for the time he'd spent in the West, he never would have had the success that he did. It gave him a common touch, a popular appeal that he didn't have and wouldn't have had otherwise.
So as a historian, I've read enough of your work to know that you want to tell stories as they happened, free of the kind of editing and embellishment that maybe characterized works of history into the mid-20th century. There's this question we're left with these days. If we know that things in our history are both good and bad, what do we do with this prescription that we ought to be proud of our history? Can we be proud of our history? Should we be ashamed of it? Or is there some third path?
So I was once asked a question. I'd written a book on Andrew Jackson, and this person came up and accused me in an accusing voice. He said, "I hope you don't admire Andrew Jackson." And I didn't know exactly how to respond, except I basically was promoting this book on Andrew Jackson, so I wasn't going to give the whole thing over. But I said, I admire Andrew Jackson's admirable qualities. And so this is the position I take on this. There are things in American history that we can be proud of. There are things in American history we should not be proud of. And the role of the historian, the role of the history teacher, I'm a teacher as well as a writer, is to let people see what this country's history was like. I'll let people do with it what they want, but it would be foolish to think that there is a unitary judgment, just a simple thumbs up or thumbs down on history. No, history is as complicated as the people who lived it. We're all complicated. If there's a single lesson of history, it is that history is complicated because people are complicated. If there's a single takeaway, it is history should teach us humility. Because we're all complicated people, and we certainly are doing things today that our descendants are going to shake their heads at and say, how could you ever have done such a thing?
H.W. Brands is Jack S. Blanton Senior Chair in History at the University of Texas at Austin. His newest book is Dreams of El Dorado, A History of the American West. Bill, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for making time to speak with us.
The pleasure's mine, Chris. Thanks.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is @KERATHINK. Wherever you get your podcast, you can find the Think Podcast, and there are 9 new episodes to download each week. If you want to find out about upcoming shows we have planned or learn more about the show, go to our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.